Well, hi there. Still working on a theme song, but this is still the Creative Writing Life podcast. I'm Paul Zeidman, and I'm quite excited to talk to my guest today. I've known him on Twitter and social media for a couple of months now. And if you haven't subscribed to his newsletter, I highly suggest you do it. He has some fantastic pieces of advice. Some of it we might even get into today. Welcome, Tom Vaughn, to the Creative Writing Life podcast.
Thank you, Paul. It's good to be here.
Oh, thank you. We're happy to have you here. And as regular listeners and viewers of the show are familiar, what we like to do starting things off, we talk about things we may have read or watched lately. And I will go first to give you a little time to think about it in your case. Well, what is that thing I watched last weekend? I was actually traveling a lot the past week, so I didn't get a chance to watch as much. And the plane's Wi-Fi was down, so I couldn't watch anything. So fortunately, I had a couple of scripts saved in my scripts to read file on my computer. So I read the script for Bottoms, which I watched a couple of probably about a month and a half ago. Really liked the movie, and the script is just as silly, but in a good way, because a lot of the jokes are so not out of left field. I guess the best way is it's there's so much suspension of disbelief for the things that the people say and what they do that the fact that they're just in there, it, I think was more amusing than what is actually transpiring on screen, but. It's a really well-written script and a great story, and just something it really, I think I mentioned this when I talked about the movie. It really kind of almost pokes fun at like 80s, 90s high school stories, that kind of genre, but in such a different way. And they have the writer had no hesitation about putting in these just ridiculous things for people to say, but they're really funny. So I think that really adds to it. So I enjoyed that. And I also got to read a couple of friends' scripts because I was giving them notes, and that was a great experience as always. And it was part of a script swap, and they liked my stuff and had some great notes on mine. So once again, very productive, and a good script swap, good script swap is always a win-win.
Yeah,
And that's what I was
huge.
that's what I was able to experience this week. So Tom, what about you?
Well, I've been watching darker TV series lately for because I just doing the comps of a project I'm working on. So I'm like, well, what are the comparisons for this? And let me see what they're doing in the networks now. So right now I've just started Fargo, the latest season of Fargo. I'm three episodes into that. And then I finished with my mother, True Detective, Night Country. And I also saw The Beekeeper with
Oh, Jason Statham.
So, and I don't know if I'm just getting easier as an audience. I don't think I am because I did start to watch one movie and I turned it off about halfway in. And I was like, this is not good stuff. This is not well done. Actress that I really enjoy, that I really like, a producer I really respect. And it just didn't work for me. So I turned it off. So let me correct that. I still can be a careful viewer, but Night Country I really enjoyed. I thought the atmosphere was great. I thought the writing was really strong. I thought the payoff was really good. Just watching Jodie Foster over six episodes is still just such a joy. She's just one of the best and has been one of the best for 50 years. So it was really great to see her in that role. And I'm having a lot of fun with Fargo. I like the actors a lot. I have definitely noticed how much I enjoy actors lately, of just seeing people that I'm familiar with, that I have a relationship with, not a personal relationship, but like an audience relationship with, and how much fun it is. There's three actors in Fargo that I watched their previous series and loved their previous series. And so watching them do this, Juno Temple and John Hamm and Joe Keenan and then seeing how great they are in this. And Joe Keenan's doing something he's never done that I've ever seen him do before. And he's really good in it. He's kind of annoying and you're kind of, and you want to see him get his comeuppance. And so it's another example. And the writing is very good. I don't mean to take away anything from the writing, but it is another example of just how much actors, take it and run and take what you do and build on it and give it something even more.
Okay, so
It's
I
the
actually
joy.
I that you raise a great point. I want to ask you this. So is it tough or Is it a challenge for you when you're watching something to, like, I guess, like, turn off your writer's brain and just be an audience member and just watch for just enjoyment? Or do you automatically, maybe if it's not, if the quality of the material is not as good, do you find yourself like drifting into writer
Oh, absolutely.
analysis?
Absolutely. And I was talking about this just the other day with my students of learning this craft will ruin most mediocre stuff for you.
Okay.
And because the mediocre stuff, and I mean the literal mediocre of just medium level stuff, that's not bad, but it's not good. You will see all the movements. You will see the steps ahead. You will see what's going on. The really bad stuff will frustrate you because you'll be like, you did this, like this doesn't, but the really good stuff, you get lost. And it is still good storytelling is still powerful enough to plow past the writer brain that you won't even realize how much you enjoyed it until it's done. And then you can be, you think about it later, impressed. For like movies that I really love, I have to watch them a second or third time before I can start to kind of break down from a writer's viewpoint, because the first time is a joy.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. Like I do with this presentation about screenwriting, and one of the things I tell the audience is that if you really want to get a good grasp of like what works in a movie and what doesn't, watch really bad movies.
Oh, yeah.
Because yeah, it's one thing to say, oh yeah, watch Casablanca, watch Chinatown, but watch something really, really bad, because then you can see like, why do you keep asking yourself, why did they do it this way? Or I don't understand the purpose of this. What about that character who was introduced in
Yeah.
Act One, but we haven't seen him since just before the end of Act Two? And all of these things, you kind of, it makes you wonder what is going on with, or what happened with the process of putting this all together. So, it's helpful to watch bad movies because they're just as helpful as good movies.
Yeah, and yeah, you can learn so much from bad movies. And also, we just kind of take good stuff for granted sometimes. We expect it to be really good, and it's really hard to do good work. There's so many variables. There's so many things that can go wrong. So a good movie is a minor, getting a movie made is a miracle. Like making a good movie is, and then making a masterpiece is an accident. I'm firm. I have become completely convinced of it, that just making a masterpiece is an accident. Everything just works out. Good people doing good work with that extra accidental level that elevates it to master.
Okay. That is a great point to start off on. So, Tom Vaughn, let's talk a little bit about you. One of the things we like to ask our guests is, were you always a writer, or was it something you kind of, not, I don't want to say stumbled into, but is it something you entered into later on in life? Or were you one of those kids like, oh, I'm constantly writing stuff and I've got a notebook with me all the time?
Yeah, I loved it early on, and I was with a student just earlier talking about this very concept of when I started writing. My writing teacher was Edward Albee, and I was a playwright at the time, and I thought I was kind of working at a different level than the other students at that point. I thought I was more talented than the other students. And as I got older, I realized, how wrong that was. And what it was that I started teach or I started acting and getting very serious about movies and acting at a very young age. And I started pretty serious actor training when I was 16 years old. And I loved movies. I loved commercial movies. Me and my brother were, of course, were those nerds making movies with our family's video camera when we were 12, 13 years old. And I had been immersed in this for so long, particularly when I started to do acting on a very serious level, that when I started writing at 21 years old, I think, I just had a lot of experience. And in my mind, I think, hey, I just started writing. And I didn't put two and two together. It's like, yeah, I started writing, but I've been thinking like this for a very long time as an actor and as someone who loved movies. And my starting point was relatively high because of that. And it wasn't that I was any more talented than anyone else. I just had a different starting point through experience of thinking in a certain way. And I've really, the last few years, particularly just being a teacher and writing professionally for almost 3 decades now, I've really changed my outlook on talent. I really changed my belief on talent, where I spent most of my early years thinking talent was an innate thing that we had. And really, I've become convinced that talent is just is a word that we use to describe how someone processes information at a certain rate. And that we process information at a faster rate, and then it looks like we're more talented because of that. But you can make up for that a lot with repetition, with hard work, through experience of how you've trained your mind. And so I went into those early classes with Edward Albee thinking, oh, I'm more talented, but I had just been immersed in this for, 10 years longer than some of the other ones. So of course it appeared that I was more talented, but I wasn't, like I just had a, I was bringing more to the table through my life experience. And when we repeat this, when we work hard, when we put the effort in, you start to make up that ground fairly quickly. You start to, like, you will start thinking about these things at a faster and faster and faster rate. So, to me, like, the big question is not so much of, hey, am I talented enough? It really comes down to, do you love doing this enough that you will keep working at it so you will eventually become talented enough? I'm not a particularly talented writer, but I busted my ass and I learned the craft. And I'm not untalented by any means, but I am mostly a result of hard work, far more so than innate God-given talent.
Yeah, I've talked about this a lot with other writers because, just trying to get a foot in the door, it's really challenging because,
Ugh.
everybody wants to do the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And that, like a lot of writers, I've had more than my fair share of, frustration and disappointment. But I say, I'd rather be frustrated and disappointed and keep writing than to even consider giving up because I love the writing part of it too much. I like writing. And, fingers crossed, God willing, and, the industry gods smile on me that, someday get to be a produced writer. That would be great. But it's really about, I love the writing part of it so much that that's why I'm willing to keep putting myself through this kind of stuff.
And you will eat yourself alive, particularly in the early years, of being result oriented rather than process oriented.
So actually, so let's so I had another professional writer on a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him, like, how did you break in? He said, I really don't like that phrase because, it's very he said it just made him feel uncomfortable. And he said he'd rather talk about how he got his start as a professional
I think
writer.
that's fair.
And I couldn't argue with him. I thought it was a great point.
As if there's a
And
barrier that you cross,
right. It's
like
like, it's
you
like
threw the
the
line and you're done, and now it's all sailing.
like it's an official door and someone opens it for you. Now you may enter. But so Tom, how did you get your start as a professional writer?
I was very fortunate. I was a result of a lot of good luck, good timing. I was a playwright, like I mentioned, and I had opened up a small theater here in Houston, and we produced one of my plays. And it's to this day, it's one of my key lessons for pushing your career ahead. But I got this great letter from Edward Albee, a letter of introduction saying, hey, this guy is worth reading. He's a good writer. And I'm sure most of your listeners know who Edward Albee is, but for those who don't, he's a three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. Up until his death, was considered the greatest American living playwright. Most famous for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, who oddly he did not win the Pulitzer Prize for. It was three other plays, so he wrote at least four masterpieces. And he was my playwriting teacher, and he wrote a great letter of introduction for me of take this guy seriously, read his stuff. And I was, I think, 23 or 24 at the time. And I thought that was my way in. I thought,
You're
certainly,
set.
I'm set. Let me just show you this letter from Edward. And so I sent that off to minimum 30 agents on both coasts, minimum, probably more like 50. And the two agencies I didn't send anything off to was CAA and ICM. The only reason I sent anything to William Morris is because that was Edward's agency. But I was not going to send something to CAA because, like, they were notorious for apparently having this wall for ridiculous people requesting to be read. And like I have no idea if this is true or not, but this was the legend, was that they would write, like, they would take these letters, these query letters, and the most ridiculous ones they would put on the wall and laugh at. And I was not going to be one of those people. I was no way was I get, they were too big, they were too huge. There was no point in, querying them at all. So I sent it off both these coasts, all these agents. No one had any interest in me. No one, a couple read, no, but they, everyone passed or didn't respond at all. So I have this theater in Houston at the time, very short-lived, but we put on a production of one of my plays, and we got a really nice review in the Houston Chronicle, the major Houston paper. And maybe a week or two later, I got a phone call from an agent at CAA who somehow the review had gotten across his desk, and he called me up to see if he could read the play. And I sent it to him. It was a low-level gangster, a play. It was, in my mind, it was David Mamet in a mafia production. Like,
Okay.
let's take David Mamet and put him into the low-level mafia. And I didn't know it at the time, but there was a film at Sundance that year called Reservoir Dogs. And so apparently low-level mafia stuff was kind of all the rage going on in all these lower level. So they didn't end up picking it up, but my who David Stein, who convinced me, hey, write screenplays, man. That's where the money is. That's my theater eventually closed. I was broke. Playwriting was clearly not a profitable endeavor. And so I went off for a year to learn screenwriting and try to figure that out, and ended up writing a really commercial script for, thank goodness I was a playwright who knew character and dialogue, but really enjoyed genre. So I sent him that script a year later, and he became my first agent for the first 7 years of my career.
And so, was that what led you to? I mean, did you submit spec scripts, or were you doing writing assignments?
Yeah, that script went out, and we didn't sell it. It was 134 page action script,
Wow. Oh my
and
gosh.
it did not sell. And this was after the spec market. This was like 95, 1994, 1995. And this is after the great huge spec market of those years had died out.
Sure.
So in my mind, I didn't know it had died out. So I'm thinking, $1 million, $2 million.
Send me my check now.
Yeah, everyone's getting it. But it didn't sell. And a producer liked it, an independent producer who I'm still working with 30 years later. Jim Wida. Jim was another young, hungry guy, and he read it and thought it was great. It needed work, but he thought it was great. And he taught me how to write a screenplay to be readable, of how to make a screenplay the most pleasant read as possible. And he really drove that into me. He was my first professional mentor. And so he taught me how to take this 136-page script, however long it was, and we just changed the action lines, and we cut 16 pages out of it just by
Wow.
writing the action lines better. And then we reworked some stuff, and we went out with it again with new action lines, and we ended up optioning it. We optioned it a second time, and then we optioned it a third time to a third company, and eventually made it. And so that movie was made. That was my first feature film. It took, I think, 6 years to get produced. And that was a film called Unstoppable with Wesley Snipes. I think you can get it in the States, or it's called Nine Lives. And eventually it got overdeveloped over the years and was a bit of a disappointment. And I jokingly, brag that I started Wesley Snipes' straight to DVD career. So, because that was his first straight to DVD movie. But I learned so much. Jim was a great mentor. We've made a lot of money together over the years as producer and writer. We're working on another project now because we're friends and we enjoy it. And went through my drinking days and my exit out of the business for a little while, maybe about 15 years ago. Jim was one of the ones that stood by me, and when I was ready to try to write again, he was there to work on something together that brought me in. So, just really one of those really valuable relationships that I've had over the years.
So it's a great point that he was able to help you, I guess, and like finesse your writing on the page. So are some of the things that he helped you with to kind of help guide you along the way, are those a lot of things that you pass on to your students as
Oh,
part of the writing classes?
No, and what Jim did more than anything was the philosophical viewpoint of the reader's experience. Like, that was the thing that he kept drilling in that has lasted my entire career of, this is for readers. We have to get by 100 readers before we make this movie. We are here to create an experience for the readers. And a lot of the stuff that he taught me, I still teach to this day. Obviously, just working in the business for, 27 years, I've learned a lot just doing it that I teach. But that basic philosophy, which is to me, like the foundation of what I teach, which is the script's job is to evoke the emotional experience of watching the movie on screen. And that's not a phrase I got from Jim, but it's a philosophy I got from Jim. And so you get that philosophy, and then after about, doing this and making a living at this for 10 years, then you're asked to teach it. You then have to figure out, how do I put this into a verbal teaching? How do I communicate this concept? How do I communicate this value system? And that's what you end up doing is, this is what I do on gut instinct. This is what I've always done. Oh, damn, now I have to explain why. Like, now I have to explain why. But when you explain why and you can figure out why and you can put it into words, what it does is it makes it a tool. And so now you're no longer kind of reliant on your talent showing up that day. You're no longer reliant on being in the mood to write that day. You now have a tool that you can access at any given time when you need it. And so that just by teaching has made me such a better writer. And as I've become a better writer, I've become a better teacher, and so on and so on. And so I've gotten to the point now where I consider myself both a writer and a teacher. And they are both very much a part of my identity in this.
Okay, that's great. That's great. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the projects that you worked on, because I know that because after I kind of discovered you, for myself at least, on social media,
Sure.
I saw that you wrote the film Winchester with Helen
Yes.
Mirren. So I watched that. So my first thought, I live in the Bay Area, so
Oh my.
I
Oh,
know what the
sure.
Winchester Mystery House
Yeah.
is. And so my first thought was, did they film it there? And then I realized they couldn't have because it's surrounded by strip malls. So they probably built this like a replica of the house. Somewhere else.
Yes,
So I
Australia.
wanted to talk about like what was your experience like? Did you come up with the idea for the story, or did someone say, "Hey, what's your take on this? Can you do a pitch on how you would write this?" I mean, what is your connection to that story?
Yeah, that was a writing assignment. So a producer, people had been trying to get the rights to the Winchester House for years, and for some reason, Brett, the producer, who's very good at eyeing like properties and ideas, he got the rights to it, and they were really struggling to get the right take. I think they had like 30 writers pitch on it. And I was in a spot in my career where I didn't have an agent at the time. I didn't have a manager at the time. And I was slowly trying to get back into the business. I got sober. I had a bad reputation for the first, 10 years of my career. I needed to kind of make up ground for that. And there were probably maybe three or four people whose relationships were intact. Every other relationship was broken, and purely my fault. No one else to blame but myself. And it was an old manager of mine. And so I reached out to Todd Berger, and said, "Hey, can we meet? I really want to kind of get into the business again." So we sat down, we had coffee, and he remembered an old script of mine, an old werewolf horror script of mine. And he said, "Whatever happened? Did you guys ever set that up? Are the rights free?" And I sent it to him. He's like, "This is just as good as I remember. Can I pass it on to these other producers that I'm working with?" I said, "Of course." And so that moved over to them. And we started moving forward with that script. But then one of the producers was on Winchester and said, "Hey, like, we haven't found a take that we like. Can you come up with something for this pitch? And just come pitch it to us. We haven't really liked anything. See what happens." And so I took a week where I just devoted myself trying to figure out, try to come up with a pitch. The financiers had financed The Woman in Black. So, and they had a huge hit with The Woman in Black. So I knew that they were not shy of a period piece. And I think a lot of the other people were, like, everyone else was pitching modern day versions of Winchester. And because I knew that they would not shy away from a period piece, I kind of focused on the origin story of Sarah Winchester, make her a character, deal with her. And of course, the big question with Sarah Winchester was always, did she see ghosts or was she crazy? And I just went through that of like, well, what is the answer to that? And then created this character that was sent there from the Winchester Company as a psychiatrist who needs to figure out, does she really see ghosts or does she? So I went in and I pitched that. And on the way home in the car, I got a phone call saying, "You got the job." And I've never got a job like within a few hours of the meeting. This was like within an hour. So they met after the meeting. Like, I left the meeting, they discussed it, decided the job is yours, and then called me up. So it was a very fortuitous situation because, like I said, I had no agent, I had no manager, my career was in shambles. And just because of old relationships, one relationship introduces another script, this introduces to another script, and just within 3 degrees of separation, now I have a writing assignment.
That's fantastic. And so, did that lead to more work, or did you sort of just kind of like, I'm just gonna take it as it goes?
It did. It got my career started again. I needed an agent. And so I had a job that needed to be negotiated. So that's always the easiest way to get an agent. And that agent had pursued me 15 years earlier. There was a time where I was a very hot commodity in LA. It was very short-lived, but there was a time where I was a very hot commodity, and a lot of agents were vying for me. And then when I left CAA, I was able to sit with every agency in town, and Scott was at this place called Genesis, and my ego was too big to be like, I'm not going from CAA to Genesis. And even though that probably would have been the right call, but my ego was, which was why a year or 2 years later, I had no career, is because of my ego. And so, but I remembered Scott and I liked Scott so much and he liked me so much. So someone said, I think it was Andy, of like, "Hey, I know this guy, Scott Henderson." I was like, "I know Scott. I remember Scott." And another older agent of mine from CAA was there over at Paradigm. So I went over to Paradigm and Paradigm negotiated the deal. And my next two projects, there was an issue with Paradigm where we just couldn't get on the same page. I was over at Circle of Confusion then as well, and that was a disaster. I did not like my manager over there much at all. It just did not vibe. And it was just a big mistake to even go there because my gut said, don't do it, don't do it. But I was so anxious to get back in the business, and Circle of Confusion wanted to rep me, and how do I say no? And One other manager I met with said no, and that scared me. That like what I've never met with a rep beforehand that afterwards said no. So that really knocked my confidence out. So I went with them, but it wasn't a good fit at all. It wasn't a good fit. And I made the choice to leave Circle of Confusion, and I made the choice to leave Paradigm, even though Paradigm was kind of the relationship had drifted so fall apart. It was kind of a mutual thing. But it was very clear. But I had two projects that I really believed in, that I had written, that were really good. I really believed in them, and they did not. And it was really, you're stuck because I have had disagreements with agents before about material, and sometimes I was right and sometimes I was wrong. And it's a really, really tough position to be in. And I just decided these are good. They're wrong, I'm right. Let me find help somewhere else.
And did that lead you to so did that pretty much like did that end the that relationship with that manager, and you just decided to I'm gonna
Yeah.
go elsewhere, and you
I'm
were able
gonna
to
go
connect with
elsewhere.
somebody?
I'm gonna be without an agent and a manager again. But I believed in these projects. And then I met a manager on Twitter. So a manager on Twitter reached out to me, and she's still my manager now, Kaylee Marsh at Brillstein, who's wonderful. And yeah, like it's a reminder that everything just kind of works out the way it's supposed to. And I made these choices, and Kaylee read these scripts. It's like, we can sell these. These are great. We can sell these. And by golly, Kaylee went out and she busted her ass and she sold them. And she sold those scripts. And I don't want to ever be in that position again. I never, because you don't know if they're right or if they're wrong. And it's tough because my relationship with ICM, I had a script that I really liked. They didn't like it. I said, fuck it, I'll go out with it myself. And I sent it out because I was at that point in my career where I had relationships at every buyer in town. I could email and call someone at every buyer. And damn it, ICM was right. That was not a sellable script. But I've also had scripts where they were wrong and we ended up selling it to Warner Brothers. And so there's no track record that says that I am more consistent about that than my reps. So I have a whole system now where I start from the very get-go with my agents over at Gersh and with Kaylee at Brillstein, where we are working together step by step through the whole process of a new spec script. So I never want to be in that position again where I have written something and my agent or my manager is like, nah, I don't like it. It's just too uncomfortable. It's too awful. It forces you to make decisions you don't want to make. So get everyone on board early, and then we'll go out with it after that.
Oh wow, that's just a roller coaster ride of a story. Just I mean it's a, it I think I what would you say is the biggest takeaway that you can pass on to people as a result of all of
I wish I knew because
that?
I I for me, my biggest takeaway from it, my biggest takeaway was what I've implemented now, which is a system so it never happens again. Because it is very tempting to go, oh, I am right. This script is fucking great and they're wrong. But certainly, if my track record, like there's not a huge data set, but it like you're well within like the means of confusion. Like there's no way it's 50-50. So the best thing to do is just avoid the situation entirely.
That is a good lesson to learn. Is it also something to definitely pass on to writers who are like, that's always the first question. How do I get an agent? How do I get a manager? And I think sometimes it's about, you have to do your research, you have to do your homework, and
Yeah.
then trust your gut is also a
Yeah.
good word of it too.
And for that part of it, of how to get a manager, how to get an agent, that I do have a good, very good takeaway and a very important takeaway, which is create on your own. do something that makes them come to you. Every single time I got an agent or a manager, it was because I had created something that attracted them to me. Every time that I have reached out to an agent saying, hey, please represent me, it's been a no. But if I've done something, whether it's write a play that was well reviewed, whether it was write a new spec script that a producer introduced them to, obviously, you know, getting a six-figure job and how, like, you need to negotiate this is the best thing, but that's obviously like the rarest of them. But every single time I had an agent or a manager is because I created something that made them come to me. Every time I've reached out to them directly, it's just human nature. It's human nature that if you are coming to them, the question is, what's the catch? Like, what's the catch? Like, why aren't you already repped? Why isn't that? Now, you can get past that with a great log line, a great killer log line that will break down doors, a killer log line. And a lot of people think a log line is about summarizing the script. And so, like, most people do really bad log lines. And the reason why they're bad log lines is because they're bad ideas. They're not sellable ideas. And so the log line doesn't help it. Like, it does no good. Like, you will never put lipstick to make that pig look pretty. Like, you just, it's still a bad idea for a commercial log line. Doesn't mean it's a bad script. It doesn't mean it's a bad script. But there's nothing there that says, this is commercial, this is a no-brainer, this will sell. And if you have a script that doesn't make a good log line, but is a very good script, you have to go through the damn contest route. You have to go, you have to do something where it becomes pre-scrutinized, where a producer says, hey, this script is great, you should rep this writer. Or something like Roadmap Writers starts, like, we love this script, and they start sending it out to their contacts. That's the only route for those scripts that are good but don't make great log lines. But if you have a great log line that's a commercial log line that makes the reader go, oh, damn, I got to read that, you don't need any of that shit. You just need that great log line, and then you need to deliver on that log line.
What if you have a really good script and then it's a really solid concept, but the log line's kind of like, you know, it's not there yet. It's like 90 or 95%.
If it is a genuinely good concept, it will make a good log line. Because that's all the log line is. This is a package for the concept. The log line itself doesn't mean shit. It doesn't. Like, no one cares. The log line represents the concept. And the concept is the thing that you are selling. The logline is just a package. The only thing that's important about the logline is the concept.
Okay, yeah, because I've heard, yeah, you know, because I've speaking from personal experience. I mean, I've gone through, if not hundreds of attempts at, like, okay, to try and get this logline where I need it to be, and you know, it's definitely in the triple digits. Like, okay, because I always start with, like, what's the formula? Here's my protagonist with a flaw, and here's what they have to achieve. Here's who or what is standing in their way.
Yeah. And
here's
what
happens. Here's what happens if they fail. And because you want to get those things in, but also that you also want to have it be so enticing that, so like you said, someone reads this, says, I have to read that script.
Because everyone, I see so many, you will figure out the formula as far as, like, this protagonist has to do this because of this. Like, that's the easiest part. And it's because it's the part that doesn't mean anything. No one gives a shit. You know, like, none of that. And I see so many people pull their hair out trying to get the wording of their log line just right, not realizing that none of that fucking matters. It's the concept. If you've got a good concept, you'll have plenty of time to finesse the log line to be the right language and like to get the protagonist and the who, what, where, and why. But none of that matters for a logline's job, which is to get someone to read the script. They want a clear, identifiable concept that offers possibilities. Like, you can't pitch the movie in a logline, but you can pitch the possibilities. So when you have a concept, like, say like a quiet place, right? The concept is if you make a noise, monsters will kill you. That's the concept, right? You can reword that concept 100 different ways. It's always going to work because the concept is if you make noise, monsters will kill you. Like, that's it. So, like, how you package it doesn't matter because all anyone cares about is like, wait a minute, you make a noise and monsters kill you? And they envision all these possibilities of the suspense, of the tension, of, oh, it's a family. Oh, that's even better. Oh, there's kids. Oh, that's fun. All they care about is make a noise, monsters will kill you. That's it. That's it. And all that dressing we put on how we format the log line and what's the formula, and none of that fucking matters because that's the easiest part of it. Like, you've got plenty of time to do it. Get the concept right, get the game right, get that thing that offers 100 possibilities that a reader will go, oh my God, I can see that movie. And then it's a huge promise of like, this is what I'm going to promise. I'm going to promise you a horror movie, and it's going to be about people. And if they make any noise whatsoever, a monster will come eat them. And then they'll be like, oh, there's a scene there. There's a scene there. Oh, you could do this. You can do this. And then you have great scenes like that movie does, a pregnant woman, and pregnant women make noise. Great. That's a whole scene. Great. A pregnant woman steps on a nail. Oh my God, that's a whole scene. That's what the log line does, is it promises possibilities. The whole, hey, a character needs to arrive, that's just really just to show you have some competence. That's really all that is that you have some competence of a story. But what we really care about is the concept.
Well, yeah, because what you were saying, that you hear the log line and you can just imagine the possibilities. I mean, like when the first Quiet Place came out, nobody thought like this is going to spawn two sequels. And so because it that they were able to really dig into the world that one log line created, like, it starts with a brilliant idea, and they're just able to go like, okay, we can do it. Like, what happened? Like, what happened before? How did the whole thing start? And who knows? I wouldn't be surprised if there's another one down the pipe somewhere. That'll come out in like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed them all. They've all been great so far.
Yeah, very much so. So let's work this. You've been writing professionally. So, and I know you're quite proud of the fact that you're now a screenwriting instructor at the
Yeah, I
University of
love
Houston.
teaching.
So how did you get into that?
I was about 10 years in, somebody asked me to teach a class. And it terrified me because I thought so many people were teaching screenwriting that had no business teaching screenwriting. And I did not want to be one of those people. And I was really afraid of those people. But I agreed to do it and I enjoyed it. I really loved it. I started out as an actor, so I enjoy talking. I enjoy being up in front of people. It really lent itself to a lot of the things that interested me. And I realized I was good at it. I enjoyed it. So I kept doing it on the side, kept doing it on the side. And eventually, when my career kind of started to fall apart, I kept doing it. It was the one thing I kept doing. And then I think around 2011, 2012, I thought I really wanted to teach at U of H because this had been a very special place for me. I started college in the 80s. In the 90s, I was a 6-year sophomore, so I dropped out of school. But this is where I started writing plays. This is where I studied with Edward Albee. And then in 2005, I went back to college and got my degree here in political science. And just that was when I took a 2-year break from the business. It's a special place to me that I really enjoy. And so I went off and I got my MFA. And it was a weird experience getting my MFA because I had a better career than my instructors. And I had to write a script adaptation class, and so I wrote Winchester during that. So I'm getting paid to write this assignment, and I'm also using it as my adaptation script for the class. I ended up selling my thesis script. So, but
Yeah.
it was a fun time. I enjoyed school, but I knew I wanted to teach at U of H, like specifically here. I didn't necessarily want to be teaching somewhere else. This is my hometown, my home school. And so as it ends up, I've been here in the 80s, I've been here in the 90s, I was here in 2005, I was here in 2017 and 18 teaching, and I'm here now from 22 to 24. So literally every decade since the 1980s, I have spent significant time at the University of Houston. And right now they're in the Sweet 16. They've got a game coming up on Friday. I've been a season ticket holder for, decades, football and basketball. It's just a huge part of my life, and I really love it here. And I just love the students as well. And it's been great. But like I said, I consider myself so much of a teacher as well as a writer. I told the administration here at the school that I would like to at the very no matter what's going on with me, I think I'll have two films in production in the fall, so I don't know if I'll be teaching my full course load, but I would like to be teaching at least one class until my retirement here at U of H. I just really, really enjoy it. And I love teaching non-students at story and plot. Like I really enjoy that. I really enjoy writing every Tuesday, the Tuesday email that I write out. I really enjoy that. I get a lot of joy out of Twitter and LinkedIn, and really like my philosophy on that is I want my free stuff to be better than anyone else's paid stuff. And I want my paid stuff to be absolutely transforming. That's what I want. I like teaching, so I do it for free. I like screenwriting. If I wasn't getting paid, I'd be doing it for free. God knows I did it for free. Still write on spec, so I always do it for free anyway. So like if you're willing to do shit for free and then get paid for it, it's just the best. It's really delightful.
Okay, so two last questions. First one is, did you get extra credit for selling your thesis
I did
screenplay?
not, damn it.
Oh,
I should have brought that up.
you should have. You really should
Yeah.
have made the argument for that one. And so what I want to kind of end on with is that, so they're all, everybody has like kind of like, I don't want to say rules, but guidelines for when they're writing. Like one of my favorites is like, write as if ink costs $1,000 an ounce, because I got that from Richard Walter at UCLA. And I just think that's brilliant. And it kind of like sums up how your script should look on the page. What are some key, I guess, takeaways that you want your students to get from the, I guess, not just for like people just starting out writing, but like for just writers overall? Are there things that, here's what you should focus on. Here's what you should convey with your story. I mean, that sort of
Yeah,
advice, you could call
there's a lot because I could just go on forever on that because I have lots of thoughts there,
I'll pick a few.
but I'll pick a few. I think there's two major things that I would like to probably, if I can address that, is one is I believe in a mission statement and a value system. I believe that having a value system of what you consider important will help you make decisions. I believe we are storytellers. I believe in defining what your story is, and therefore you have a definition of what story is. But my primary values are story and emotion. And that if you know what story you're telling and you know what emotion you're trying to evoke, that will get you out of most trouble. And you need to be making those choices of what those things are. The story will guide you. If you know what the story is, and I believe story is transformation of either a character changes or a character remains steadfast and changes those around them, or it's a tragic story where they fail to change or change for the worse. Define what that story is. That's your mission statement. That's your guiding principle through the whole thing. That act one is there to establish who that character is. Act two is designed to change that character. And act three is how that character solves whatever their problem is because of that change. That's your mission. Everything follows through on what your story is. So to do that, you have to define what story you're telling. Put it up on the wall, put it up on your monitor, wherever you put it. This is a story about this person who goes through this and becomes this person. Everything has to affect that either pushes them towards their ultimate destination, resists them and pushes them back, or diverts them in a different direction. One of those three things. And then the next thing that I consider our overriding value system is emotion, that we are an emotional delivery system. We are here to evoke emotion from the audience. And as screenwriters, particularly when we're writing on spec, our audience is the reader. We are trying to evoke emotion from that reader. And in order to evoke emotion from that reader, you have to choose what emotion you're trying to evoke from that, from that reader. So making that choice. And that's a slight variation of my second point, which is just make choices. Just make choices. Whatever that moment is, whatever is going on, whatever that image is, whatever that moment is, whatever that dialogue is, make definitive, decisive choices. People do not realize how much they write out of bad habit rather than making deliberate choices. And if you know what emotion, what image, what thing you want the reader to experience through every step of your script, you are ahead of 99% of screenplays, professional and non-professional alike. It's amazing how many times we don't make choices, and we'll write words out, but like we think we made choices, but because we put words on the page. But we didn't really make any choices. Everything is blah, 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 rather than decisive. This, this, this. Everything has a purpose. And so part of my job as a screenwriting teacher is to get writers to stop writing out of bad habit and make everything a conscious choice.
Okay. Wow. That's great stuff. I mean, a story and emotion that really is kind of like, you can't add any more simple or definitive than that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the base. It's the foundation of everything we do.
Okay, great. Tom Vaughn, this has been a great and entertaining and informative
time to talk with you.
I just loved everything that you had to say. So where can people find you online, especially if they want to subscribe to your very, very helpful newsletter?
Thank you. Go to storyandplot.com. And the very first thing the website will ask you is, hey, do you want to sign up for this weekly email that I do? And if you want to take courses with me, you can do that. But I really encourage people of like, before you take a course with me, subscribe to the email. You'll get emails from me. You'll see what I do. You'll see what I teach. You'll see my philosophy, how I approach everything. I think once you get a view of all of that, you'll feel pretty comfortable. And if you want to get more detailed, you can always, enroll in a course. But I, like I said, I really believe in making my free stuff better than anyone else's paid stuff. So if that's all you do is just sign up for the email, you'll still get tons out of it.
Yeah, I can definitely attest to that because I have a few of the newsletters that I've received over the past couple of months. They're still in my, because I read them. And I was like, okay, I want to hold on to this one. So I mark it as unread. So they're still there.
Oh,
so that
great.
So that I can go back and reread them because I found that a lot of the information, it was really helpful. I mean, you know, I've been doing this a long time and I've read a lot of books and read tons of scripts, but there's always some helpful information that comes along that it might be something you hadn't thought of before, or it's a different take on it. And it's just, it really strikes a chord. And so a lot of the things that you've said over the past couple of months that I've been getting the newsletter, some of them just really have stuck with me. I'm like, okay, I have to hold on to this because this is really good stuff and I don't want to forget it. And so it's there as a reminder, but also kind of as a resource for me. So the website is storyandplot.com. We talked about this before we started recording. It's story and the word and, not
and,
story
yes.
ampersand plot.
Yeah.
And you're also on Twitter, and that is also at storyandplot.
Yep. And I'm I have different content on Twitter and LinkedIn. So join me there both.
Okay, fantastic. Tom Vaughn, thank you so much for being on the Creative Writing Life podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Has been great stuff.
I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Okay, well, he is Tom. I am Paul Zeidman. You can check out my screenwriting blog at Maximum Z, maximumz.blog. I'm still on Twitter as well at maximum_Z. I'm also on LinkedIn and also on Instagram at Pez Screenwriting, at PEZ Screenwriting. And you can check out the show's the show's Twitter account at Podcast CWL for Creative Writing Life. Like you said, he's Tom. I'm Paul. This has been the Creative Writing Life podcast. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and most importantly, go write something.